Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. St. Louis is renowned for its historic architecture, but not all of it is in the best of shape. A little later on today's program, we'll talk about efforts to preserve some of our most significant landmarks. But first, recollections of a terrible chapter in recent world history, the Bosnian War. Joining me in studio is Kenan Trebinjevic. He is a Bosnian Muslim now living in New York who fled the war in his homeland two decades ago as genocide was taking hold. His story is likely similar to that of many of the Bosnians who have settled in our community. His story is recounted in his book, The Bosnia List, A Memoir of War, Exile, and Return. It tells of his experience when the war erupted, his exile to the U.S., and the return to his homeland years later to confront his past. Kenan joins me in studio. Kenan, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for coming.
You too, Mr. Marsh.
Let's talk about your desire to write this book. I think a lot of people would be surprised that someone would want to write about many, many painful memories. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I'll tell you a quick short story how it started. I'm a physical therapist, works in Manhattan. I live in Queens, New York. 2 years ago, I had a Jewish journalism professor, memoirist. She was my patient. She never paid attention to her exercises. We always joked about it. Every time we walk away, she would take another pile of essays from her bag and start grading. So one time I jokingly walked over and asked if the assignment was what I did on my summer vacation. And she said, actually, the first assignment I give to my students is to write 3 pages about your most humiliating secret. So I looked at her and said, you Americans, said, why would anyone reveal that? And she said, because it helps you heal and editors want unusual voices. So I said, So that night, I remember emailing her to ask her how her back was feeling, and she sent me a piece her female student had just published about how her mother and herself, Holocaust survivor, ate bacon cheeseburgers on Yom Kippur to cope with the anniversary of suicide of a father. And that unlocked something in me. Mm-hmm. And I've never written anything before. I was a science major, studied anatomy and not literature. And next time she came, I showed her 3 pages, and she looked at it, and she said, wow, this is Muslim male Anne Frank who survived. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, keep writing. And after a couple of rewrites, actually, that essay, the first 3 pages I wrote and rewrote, wound up in New York Times Magazine. Then I took a book seminar class when I met the agent who thought that we should expand it to memoir. So I asked Susan to help me with it. And while it first became a personal manner, I realized that I had this moral obligation to tell a story, not just for myself, especially my people, and anyone who's been persecuted because of religion, nationality, or ethnicity.
Just to be clear, this was Susan Shapiro, the co-author of
correct.
Your book.
Yeah.
And you made a reference to Anne Frank. What did she mean by that?
Well, she meant by the famous Anne Frank book, her diary. And when I was so confused, I'm like, what does Anne Frank have to do with me? And she said, well, you know, this is what happened to you, except, you know, you made it out. It's a similar story.
But and she also said, if I remember having read this somewhere, that and perhaps it was you who said it, that you found that Jewish people were most understanding of your story and the story of the people like you.
Well, I thought that out of anyone in the world, especially modern day Europe, they experienced similar faith, you know, starting from Spanish Inquisition in 1492 and through 1940s.
So there is a connection.
Parallel,
there.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about your story. And you're going to be appearing tonight at the St. Louis County Library at 7 o'clock. And before we went on the air, you said that you didn't expect many people from the St. Louis Bosnian community, which is a very large community, as you know, to be there. Why don't you expect your Bosnian compatriots to be there?
It's not out of support. It's out of tiredness of hearing about the same story for over 2 decades. Everyone wants to move on. But every time you go online and read a Bosnian newspaper, there's always a story that takes you back to that time period. So I thought this is just anyone else's story. Why would they want to come and hear their own story and be forced to remember all those years?
Yeah. And you believe, though, and I guess know, that many of the people who live here also come from your small community.
Yeah, I was telling John Pertzborn this morning that at the entrance to my hometown in Brčko, as you're crossing over Croatian border into Bosnia, there's a huge sign that says, welcome to Brčko, Bosnia, brotherly city of St. Louis. So it's the largest Brčko population outside of Brčko.
Well, let's see how many show up tonight. Yes. Again, 7 o'clock, St. Louis County Library on South Lindbergh. Tell us about Brčko as things were changing for you as a young man.
In 1991, when war started in Croatia, towards the end of it, I started noticing changes on the streets, political parties, rallies, and even our soccer games and playgrounds started to become segregated. My old classmates and friends started playing war games. They said Bosniaks on that side with Croats, we don't be on separate side.
Christians and, versus Muslims.
And they imitated wartime criminals such as Arkan at the time and calling us Bosniaks or Balia, which is ethnic slur for Bosnian Muslim.
Mm-hmm. And the war was just breaking out. You were feeling this kind of pressure, this segregation. Take me a little farther in this story. How did it progress?
I would come home from school and I expect to play a soccer game. My friends wouldn't call me, so I would look out the window and ask them why they pick me for the game, and they would just ignore me. So when I walk downstairs, usually one of our Bosniak friends and I would get picked first, and we would get picked last or not at all. Mm-hmm. Then they would make comments about what's going on the other side of Bosnia. I remember there was a Muslim holiday at the end of Ramadan. There was a slaughter in a town called Birna, and they were laughing about it and saying how they can't wait that it happens, to us.
But aside from this feeling of being set apart, was there conflict? Was there military conflict around you that you could watch or see or feel?
Only on TV in Croatia. I remember sitting on the third floor balcony and seeing distant flashes in the skies and roaring skies in Croatia, but we never thought it would come to us.
But what you were feeling was you were pitted neighbor against neighbor.
Correct.
And how did that manifest itself?
It manifested itself on May 1st of 1992 when the war arrived. It was just all of a sudden overnight. A couple days into the war, I went out to buy a loaf of bread, and in the store, an old neighbor who knew my mom said to me, "You're not welcome in the store anymore. You Turks won't be needing to eat soon anymore."
Why Turks?
Well, they refer us to because we embraced Islam in 1463. So to me, it was confusing. I said to myself, I thought I was Bosniak, not a Turk. And on the way home, I bumped into my old favorite teacher, Milutin, because a bullet almost grazed my head. And I went for cover behind his back, and he grabbed me by left sideburn and cocked a gun to my forehead. And he was so confused. He was looking at the gun as if it got jammed. And I tugged away and picked up a bag of bread that he knocked out of my hand when he said, "Balia don't need bread." And on the way home, I turned around and he was showing me the three-finger salute, the nationalist insignia.
We have heard much about the camps. Did you experience that?
Myself, no. But my brother and father were held in prison temporarily for 14 days. First couple of weeks in the war, when we were stuck in the apartment, we saw trucks of dead corpses by our building. They were coming from the famous or notorious camp, Luka, concentration camp. And basically knocked on the door when my favorite coach, karate coach, my old mentor, came in with his angry army troops shouting, "You have 1 hour to leave or be killed," before he took my dad and brother to the camp himself.
And your mother?
My mother actually stayed with me.
Right.
Then we reconnected after we were released. We actually had to leave the apartment and stay with my aunt. We tried leaving the first time, but we were kicked off the checkpoint and ordered to march forward. We thought we were going to get killed by this tall guy in a black paramilitary uniform, and we ended up in a village that was a makeshift camp, not a concentration camp, but more like a ghetto for Bosniaks and Croats, Muslims and Catholics.
You were 11 or 12 years old at this time?
I was 11.
We have to move this along because it's a long story and it's a complicated story. When did you decide, you and your family, to get out?
Well, we tried six times, and for 10 months we were tormented by neighbors and kicked off at checkpoints. So on January 3rd, 1993, through heavy, strong connection through a Bosnian Serb police chief, he called the border. And with lots of luck and a blizzard, we made it out of Bosnia and landed in Austria and lived there for 10 months until we were accepted by Connecticut Interfaith Council to migrate to the United States.
And what was that like, that transition?
Transition for me? I used to watch 90210 Beverly Hills and old American shows. So for me, I thought I was going to be in a red convertible with Kelly Taylors and palm trees and surfing.
Well, how did that work out for you?
Didn't see any palm trees. However, I was very lucky to be embraced by people of many backgrounds, religions, especially first day of school. Dr. Hightower of Bedford Middle School in Westport, Protestant, Drape put his hands around my shoulder, introduced me to the class, and a Catholic Spanish kid named Miguel offered me a desk. Then he took me to a cafeteria and shared his tater tots with ketchup, my first American food.
Was all of your family with you?
At that point, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Moving ahead. You were making an adjustment to life in America. Was it a difficult adjustment for you? I mean, there was no red Mercedes convertible
or pretty girls waiting
necessarily.
For me, I use sports to learn how to speak English and assimilate. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I gained a lot of friends. That was my ticket, sports. For my brother, it was a little harder because he had to get to college, so he was studying for SATs.
Right. So you were integrating yourself
yes.
into this new society, learning the language and all the rest of it. At some point, though, obviously, you must have begun to think about going back because that's exactly what you did. What was that process like?
So after 2 decades in the States, my father desperately wanted to visit bridge school again. That was in 2011. And being a wonderful father who never said no to anything my brother and I asked for, we agreed to take him. So at first I felt that, oh, we're only doing this for dad. But then I felt that it was time for me to face down my past.
And this was 2011.
2011.
Was your mother still alive?
No, she passed away in 2007.
Okay. Well, getting it together to go back, what were your motives in going back? I can understand wanting to go back to your old hometown, but it was mm-hmm. more to it than that, Kenan, was it not?
Vacation for most 30-year-old single American guys meant partying and romance. On my agenda was visiting graveyards, monuments, and confronting the betrayers who turned on my family. So the town that is pretty much segregated due to the way the war ended, I thought, what am I going to do when I run into old war criminals or neighbors who wanted us dead? I wasn't scared for myself. I was actually scared for them.
So did you run into any?
I ran into Petra, our thieving next-door neighbor who stole from my mother. And she was the one that would come during the war and walk in our apartment as if it was hers without knocking and say, you might as well give me that rug or skirt because you won't be needing it much longer.
So she was just stealing from your
family? Stealing,
yes. Was she the only one doing that sort of thing?
Now we had soldiers coming in. They would just take anything they wanted. We had a couple from Belgrade, my co-author Coles and Bonnie and Clyde. They would come in and they would just scare us with their hand grenades and say how many Muslims they killed. And they would actually one day made my father unscrew a chandelier from the ceiling and made him and I carry in the wheelbarrow from our apartment to her new house, which she stole.
Again, I have difficulty understanding why someone would want to go back to what had happened there.
We're the only – at one point I thought we're the only – people from Bursko didn't go back. We have family that we left, cousins, and I never see these little, you know, guys and little kids grow up. And it was, you know, I felt that I'm going to go back on my own terms and leave without getting kicked out. Because all I remember is being that 12-year-old boy. So when I went back, I still had that mind frame of a 12-year-old boy. Even when I landed, I still felt like I was being pushed out. So I wanted to prove to myself and them that, okay, I'm 30 years old at a time. This is not 1992. I'm as powerful as you are, if not more. There are no guns. We're back in town. I wanted to, you know, prove a point. So it was more like a vendetta.
A vendetta. The vendetta being just your mere presence there. Did you entertain any thoughts of taking any kind of action against some of these people who had been so terrible to you and your family?
Of course. I even brought this up to my neighbor who lives in Queens, and he said, oh, that's so normal. You know, you want to shoot Igor or beat him up. And he's like, everyone that goes back for the first time has the same, you know, fantasies. You know, I consider myself a regular guy, more into soccer and Seinfeld reruns. But the moment I decided to visit my home, I started having vengeful fantasies of inviting these guys over to barbecue and, you know, finding a way to hurt them.
And when did these kinds of thoughts begin to dissipate?
From what I was seeing, especially when I re-met Petra for a 45-minute talk, and realizing my life here that I have built in the States, which I did not want to ruin. I did not want to disappoint my parents, my colleagues, my mentors. It would have been a big loss if I got arrested for anything. And my mom would probably turn in her grave if she knew that I got arrested or got into trouble. And just comparing our life, seeing that these people live in the mess that they have created. They don't have schools finished. They barely live from one paycheck to the next. And I built a decent life for myself in the States, and I have friends and family who always been supportive of me.
Tell us in more detail about your meeting with Petra. This is the woman who had stolen all these things from your mother, had stolen furniture, had stolen dresses and that sort of thing. Did she recognize you after 20 years?
Our first encounter was when she saw me standing over a balcony, and she got really startled. She put her grocery bags down, which I really wanted to kick it and see those tomato splatters so she can pick them up. And she smoked a cigarette. She was nervous. And when she walked up to her third floor door, I just looked at her and said, "No one has forgotten." And she released this little sigh. She looked down and opened a door. A few days later, I knocked on the door. She wasn't home. Her daughter was there. And my goal was to confront her. And, of course, my brother came after me because he was scared. He was like my shadow. And I'm honestly having like 4 or 5 minutes conversation with her. She didn't show guilt. She has shown remorse to what happened to us. But just like lots of Bershko Serbs, when you've seen for the first time, they blame it on politicians. "Look what they have done to us, those bastards. I can't believe they threw you out." She said, "I will never steal it from your mother. She allowed me. She gave me your bed sheets when you guys left. She gave me your skirt." That's before I even asked her anything. I just sat there and listened. So either she had 20 minutes to change the whole history in her head, or she had the 20 minutes to recreate the story while she was coming back from school. She's a teacher now.
How about your father and your brother were with you? What was their reaction to this return?
To her apartment?
No, to your town.
My town. My dad was disappointed because there are a lot of his friends and he was a sports trainer, a coach, athletes who have died. So going back and seeing the graves of all those, that really has touched them in a certain way. And it's not the same town that they remember. So we all came to the realization, you know, America's our home. And we do have a few friends there that we like to stay in touch with. There's a connection, but the town is not the same. It's like a ghost town.
Well, after 20 years, most towns do.
But just there's no life. We lived in the city with a huge river, so they had regattas, they had the fishing tournaments, people meet at the city square. That only happens now when people from diaspora come from St. Louis. So everyone knows that town is going to make money between May and June, and that's when you see people. You see people who live in St. Louis or Germany. The locals have died off or moved away.
We had said before going on the air that there may be as many as 1 million Bosnians who are scattered around the world. It's quite a community. It's a wonderful and a rich community here in St. Louis. Really sticks together, has come together and made much of themselves as individuals. They've started businesses. There seems to be a quality about people from this part of the world to do that sort of thing, to bounce back.
Yeah, my parents, when we came here, you know, I was an angry 15-year-old boy. And they would say, "We're going to the United States. We're going to be nobodies, so you boys can be somebodies. And we're going to do jobs we've never done before, but we're here for your future." So I'm glad that most Bosnians that I even know, even they live in Queens, have finished colleges. And they didn't rely on, you know, government's money to, you know, like food stamps. You know, if you're capable to work and work hard, you know, America will give you options. That's the best part about the country is options. And if you do a good job, no one cares about your name, as far as I know, religion, skin color, or nationality.
Were you changed at all by this return trip home?
Yeah, like through the process. Like Susan would tell me, she quoted Susan Shapiro, my co-author, would quote Joan Didion line, "I write to find out what I think." And that really touched me in a certain way, and it came out to be true. You know, I felt this like mouse in a maze where every time I remember another story and I had to regress to that time period, there was one more roadblock I had to find my way around. So while at first I felt like a young boy who lost his happy childhood, I came to understand how amazingly happy we were. And by reliving what happened to me, it made me stop clinging to a two-decade-old anger over what Serbs did to us. And for the first time, see my past with different set of eyes. I mean, I'm a person who still holds grudges, and resentment will never disappear. But I feel more lucky than bitter.
You know, I've read that you took this trip on what might be called a mission of hate, but there was this this transformation. Was there a moment when you suddenly realized that I've got to push the hate part aside and go to a different level?
My mom always – I remember my mom said when we were finishing the book, Susan and I, we thought, okay, well, how do we finish this? Like, where's the arc? And basically my mom always used to say that we should never forget those who did us harm, but we should also remember the good people too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I do mention and honor good neighbors who have come to our aid, because ultimately it's because of them, you know, we're alive. Mm-hmm. And the good deeds, or even of war criminals, that actually saved my dad in camp. Well, I mean, they're awful people. But I had a hard time really trying to understand, why did he save my dad? Like, what was different about my dad than any other dad who was as innocent as my dad?
And what was the answer? Did you ever get an answer to that question?
I actually explained it in the book, which I don't want to give it away. To this particular individual, should I say.
Yeah. Okay. How about changes in your father?
My father felt that he was reborn when he went back. He felt that he has been forgotten. And he, when we sat there at a cafe, all these people came and approached him. You know, he was like unofficial mayor of the town. And he just felt somebody again. And again, and then he finally embraced still the America is his country. You know, he was missing it for years, but because of what war did, you know, he came to terms that this is my home, this is where I'm going to be buried.
Did he have any regrets, and did you have any regrets about having made this trip?
No, zero. I wouldn't change anything different about it, and I'd like to go back in 2015.
Why?
I still have an aunt left, cousins, and dad's friends, so I'm also going to do for dad as well.
You were able to see friends as well as
his friends. I don't have any childhood friends that live there, but I consider his friends my friends because now we're adults, so we can have conversations I couldn't have with them when I was 11 or 12. So that's really interesting.
One of the key characters in your book was your karate coach,
Pero. Yeah,
yeah, and you wanted to pay particular attention to his grave. I understand why.
Mm-hmm. I want to stand over his grave, and I want him to feel the rumble. That I'm standing above him 20 years later, and he's the one that, you know, has made poor choices in his life.
Did you get a feeling of satisfaction for having done that?
Yes, but it doesn't change what he did to us. Mm-hmm. But then I realized what the trip also did for me is I realized who these characters were before the war. I learned, which I didn't know as a kid. So the things that have – the war makes you – war brings the best or worst out of someone. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to him, I learned who he really was during war. So someone like Pedro Ranco, which I mentioned in the book, they couldn't be themselves before the war. So the war only allowed them to be themselves.
What specifically did he do to you?
It's what he did to my dad, and my brother. Mm-hmm. He threw him in a camp. He didn't throw me in a concentration camp, but he threw them. And also, I ran into him on the street in August of 1992, and he was standing with a pretty girl holding a gun. And he looked at me, pointing his finger at me, and just laughed maliciously. And I, under my breath, I muttered, I hope you die. And, you know, my words actually caught up with him because he was shot to death by one of his own not too long ago after that.
How do you explain this transition? I mean, he was your friend one day. He was your coach. He was your friend. You got along. And then the next thing you know, he's pointing a gun at you.
Well, he even went after his other fellow martial artists. Who were his age, 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. I was just a kid. I understand he loved me and cared me at the time. But when the war started, he went after people he was jealous, who had more money than him, who had wives. They were more successful. So he was always angry and bitter, second grade person, what my brother explains.
We only have a very short time left. Yeah. There are a number of Bosnians, I'm sure, who are listening to this program. What would you tell them with regard to your experience in going back? Would you suggest that they do the same thing? Is it a worthwhile, a cathartic thing to do?
It was soothing and addicting as well. I think everyone has their own process they need to figure out for themselves. I'm one of the only ones who went there, I think, last. I think they've all been there way before me. Mm-hmm. So many wondered, why don't you guys go back? What's taking you so long? And I think it's a very individual formula or concoction that you need to put yourself on the trip to do. I didn't know what I was going to expect. I just got a ticket and left.
Would you ever entertain, and I think I know the answer to this question, but would you ever entertain the notion of going back there permanently? It is your homeland.
No, I couldn't fit in there. The lifestyle is different. And I'm proud to be Bosnian Muslim, but I have embraced and enjoy my American identity as well. And I'm very proud to be an American citizen. And, I mean, you know, this is where I belong. I can't – you know, the mind frame of people down there is very different. I got an argument It was like a 2-second argument with a guy when I said, you know, in Egypt, in such a Muslim country, people protested and they overthrew the government. And I'm like, Balkanites can do it easily. What do you know? You live in America. You live on the left. So I knew not to argue.
A lot of Muslims in this country who have not had a particularly easy time of it since 9/11. I mean, there have been a number of incidents, and there has been evidence of discrimination. Have you run across any of that?
Personally, no. And even my own friends didn't ask me, what do you think about what happened? Like, I mean, obviously they know it's a terrible tragedy, which I totally agree. And I expressed many, many times the awfulness of what has happened. But I never felt any persecution or bad looks or anything from anyone.
All right. I'm going to have to end it there. I'll remind the audience that Kenan Trebinchevich will appear at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on South Lindbergh tonight at 7 o'clock. You have a photo presentation as well.
Oh, I do? I didn't know that.
Oh, I thought you said you had some photographs you were going to show.
Oh, I'm sorry. The PowerPoint presentation, yes.
Okay.
Which authenticates the story and makes the story more exciting.
Okay. Well, again, 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library. Kenneth, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on the book, and I hope you have a nice turnout tonight.
I already have. Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment. Musician Pokey Lafarge, I'm sure that name is familiar to many of our listeners. He is on the bandwagon now for historic preservation. We'll talk about the effort to save historic venues in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.